Hello and welcome back to the course on Critical Theory, Cultural Studies, and Postmodern Theory, Considered in Terms of Liberty. This is Lecture 2. In Lecture 1, we introduced the three schools of thought. We looked at their approaches, how they approached the problems that they saw, and what their relationship was to those problems as well as to Marxism itself. That is necessary because Marxism informs them. Today, we're going to look at some of the main precursors to the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory, an understanding of which, without which we cannot really understand the Frankfurt School and what their orientation was and what they were doing. So we want to look at these thinkers not for the entire corpus of their thought, but rather for what they contributed to and what the Frankfurt School took from them and what they did with those ideas. So let's jump in. There are three main precursors to the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory, and those are George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, who lived from 1770 to 1831, Karl Marx, who lived from 1818 to 1883, and Georgi Lukács, who lived from 1885 to 1971. So let's begin with Hegel. There he is in all his glory. Hegel was a German philosopher, in particular a German idealist. He wrote in the vein of the German idealist movement, which began with Johann Fichte and continued with Immanuel Kant. But Hegel's idealism was, of course, different from those, and we'll talk about what his idealism consisted of. You might compare the idealism of Hegel with that, for example, of the British philosopher George Berkeley. George Berkeley's idealism was a subjective idealism. That is, the experience of the world was completely subjective and idealistic. That is, it resided in the mind. It did not reside in any concrete object world corresponding to it. Thus, this the town of Berkeley. And this idealism was not an objective phenomenon. So it's similar to Kant. Kant, who posited basically that the subject determines what they experience. There is no access to the objective world as such. It exists as an impenetrable, transcendental object which the subject does never really know. Now, for Kant, it existed and somewhat informed the subjective, but it's not a matter of extent. The access to it was not there. We can compare that and Hegel to Platonic idealism, which is an objective idealism. There are these forms that exist, but they pre-exist matter. And any instantiation of them, they are eternal, they're static. Hegel differs from that in that his idealism is objective too, but it is not static, it is changing. It is based and premised on change. I should note that the subjective idealism differs from Hegel in that Hegel's idealism is objective. That is, it exists in the objects. Let's explain. For Hegel, there's this divine mind which is immanent in matter, and matter, so it's not an immaterialism as such. It's an idealism that's not an immaterialism. Matter is an expression of this objective ideal world. It is an expression of divine mind. Matter is objectified spirit, really. What he saw was this divine mind, immanent in matter. It is conscious. It's a self-conscious. It's a self-conscious object. So therefore, he's merging the subjective and the objective into one. The object world and the subject world are conflated or joined. Okay, and this self-consciousness finally self-actualizes, if you will, as God, or so it's an absolute idealism in the end, although there is all this change that takes place in the process. You could also see this self-consciousness, by the way, is human, but it's a collective consciousness. It is not this is not the self-consciousness of singular persons, but the collective consciousness of the human, which becomes or actualizes as, or finds out that it is, God. That's the progress narrative that he deals with, and we'll talk about that right now. So what history is the development of spirit through time. And it's a progressive history. It's moving forward, and it has stages of spiritual progress. But it's moving towards an end. It's teleological, and it finally ends in absolute spirit, or the self-actualization of God as God, which is the human consciousness. So in effect, this is the apotheosis of humanity as a whole. And therefore, this is a very significant derivative of the Christian eschatology, in which we end up in heaven or hell or whatever. But whatever happens here, it is the actualization of God, absolute spirit. And so this is certainly the apotheosis of the human. It's the humanization of Christianity, in effect. So let's continue. What are we getting out of this? Let's talk about it. What is important from Hegel to get is Hegel's dialectic. His dialectic is the process of all history and change. For example, being and non-being are the first elements in the dialectic, and from being and non-being you get existence. It is not that something came out of nothing. It is that nothing and being coexist, and from them comes existence itself. So he posits a thesis, an antithesis, and a synthesis. The thesis is the statement, the antithesis is its contradiction, and from this statement and contradiction comes a third term known as the synthesis. And there are particular examples we can talk about, but I'm going to only use one, and that is the master-slave dialectic. When a human being is confronted with another human being, Hegel posited that there was a relationship established between these human beings in terms of master and slave. One either was a master or a slave in any particular confrontation. Now, the master and the slave are dialectically related. That is to say, the master is only a master because the slave is a slave, and the slave is only a slave because the master is a master. On the other hand, they partake of each other to some extent because their very identities depend on the other. Therefore, they're in a dialectical relationship, and their very identities are produced by virtue of the relationship. Now, out of the relationship comes a third term. In this case, it would be the free man, whose identity is determined by having been the product of that synthesis. So that takes us to Karl Marx. Marx, of course, was also a German philosopher. He came out of the Hegelian movement, and he was a young Hegelian, if you will, but he broke from it, not so much in terms of the dialectic, but in terms of his materialism. He would break from Hegelian, the young Hegelians, they were called, over this difference. Marx is an historical materialist. It is said that he stood Hegel on his head. And what this means is that Marx took Hegelian idealism and ascribed its features to the material economic world, to material and economic development. So he takes the dialectic, he takes the process of history, he takes the teleology and the end and the self-actualization or the actualization of history into the material realm. He stood Hegel on his head, but it's not to be forgotten that it was Hegel that he stood on his head and not somebody else. So it's Hegel's methodology and his basic epistemology and his ontological assumptions he takes and imports into Marx. The ontological assumptions are that identity is developed by virtue of contradiction, and that change happens on the, by virtue of this contradiction of reduced third terms. So here's Marx in A Critique of the German Ideology, actually written with Engels, published in 1845, or written in 1845. The premises from which we begin are not arbitrary ones, not dogmas, but real premises from which abstraction can only be made in the imagination. They are real, the real individuals, their activity, and the material conditions under which they live, both those which they find already existing and those produced by their activity. These premises can be verified in a purely empirical way. So Marx differentiates himself from idealism by asserting an empirical reality that is valid, that we can see, and that we can experience otherwise. These are the real premises. Notice the emphasis here that I'm putting on words, real, material, as opposed to imagination and abstraction. What he's getting at here is basically a break with German idealism. He's saying that instead of starting from the ideas, which idealists had posited as prior to material instantiation, he says the material is where we should start, because this is where ideas come from, or any ideas we have are derived from the material conditions of our living. Anything else is a product of that. So he's going to really revolutionize this idea that the ideal world, or ideas, or ideation, or forms, or anything, is prior to actual material reality. And important here is the dialectic as well. That is to say, not only is this material, but it is dialectical. The history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggles. This is from the Communist Manifesto in 1848, written also with Engels. So we're going to see that this is really an import from Hegel. Marx imported the Hegelian dialectic and applied it to the material economic realm. And here's an illustration of that. This is history as the history of class struggle. You have a dialectical relationship between the capitalist and the proletariat. The third term deriving from that conflict or contradiction is this classless society. And once again, the identity of the various players in this scenario are determined by the opposition to what they are not. The capitalist is only a capitalist because the proletariat is a proletariat, and the proletariat is only a proletariat because the capitalist is a capitalist. Their identities as such in this conception are dependent on the other to which they are opposed. And from this opposition and contradiction comes the classless society, putatively. Another major prong of Marxism, which is necessary to get because from it derives his whole theory of exploitation, is the labor theory of value, or LTV. And the labor theory of value, it wasn't his original idea. I believe he got it from the earlier political economists. I'm not sure from which. But it holds that the value of a commodity is equal to the socially average labor time required to produce it. Okay. A commodity is worth the socially average labor time necessary for its production. So value is labor embodied in objects or other things, even in abstractions with intellectual property. But labor is valued, is value. Value is labor, more importantly. Labor Theory of Value. This is from Capital, Volume 1, Chapter 7. It's published in 1867. Each of these units is the same as any other. This is commodities now he's talking about. Their similitude has to do with the fact that they contain a certain, they embody a certain value of labor. So far as it has the character of the average labor power of society and takes effect as such, that is, so far as it requires for producing a commodity, no more than is needed on an average, no more than is socially necessary. The labor time socially necessary is that required to produce an article under the normal conditions of production and with the average degree and intensity prevalent at that time. So this is just basically saying the same thing that I just did, except in his words, that the value of a commodity is the average, socially average amount of labor time required to produce it. So he's accounting for differences in workers and processes and so forth. So the theory of exploitation, as I said, really rests on the labor theory of value. The theory of exploitation holds that the surplus value is extracted at the point of production by the capitalist. The capitalist gets more value from the product of labor than he invests in value. And the investment is in the commodity of labor. The surplus value derives from labor time that is not paid for. Marx put this in terms of hours. To translate it into contemporary terms, we would say the worker works 8 hours but gets paid for 4. The difference is the margin of exploitation. Exploitation equals the difference between the value of the commodity and the labor time for which the worker is paid. Now, there are other theories for this difference, and I'm not going to go into them here, but you probably know what they are. Therefore, the value of labor power, Marx said in Volume 1 of Capital, Chapter 7, and the value which that labor power creates in the labor process are two entirely different magnitudes. And this difference of the two values was what the capitalist had in view when he was purchasing the labor power. That is, that he would pay for X and get X plus in the process. Now, the Orthodox Marxism derives from these principles, and this is Marx's original view, but which he diverged from late in life when he saw that it wasn't working. There are stages of economic systems and their attendant social relations. So feudalism is a stage of economic development. It's a static hierarchy of serfs and the aristocracy. Capital is static in the moment, that is to say, there is no movement of the players within it. But it does eventually change, obviously, and that's what he thinks anyway. Capitalism is, you have the capitalist and the proletariat, and then socialism, you have a classless society. How does it change? How does one change to the other? There's a contradiction between the relations of production and the social relations, which leads to change in the economic system. The relations of production means who does what, that is, what role do they play in the productive process? And the social relations refers to who owns what, like who controls and owns these means. According to Orthodox Marxism, when the social relations no longer adequately correspond to the relations of production, or vice versa, when the relations of production no longer adequately correspond to the social relations, a change in this economic system necessarily results. So what he's saying is there's a point at which the relations of production are so different from the social relations, that is, who's doing what and how it is done, when they become so distinct from the social relations, when they no longer resemble each other, at some point there is a change. Why is that? Well, there's conceived here of a tipping point, of course, or something like what Hegel called the dialectic of quantity and quality, when a quantity reaches a certain point, it actually changes into a different quality. We could look at this in a real pedestrian way by thinking of boiling water. When water is heated to a certain point, it eventually leaves its liquid state and it becomes a vapor. Or if it goes the other way, it becomes a solid. So there is a point at which this correspondence is so off that it has to change. So for Marx, to development to socialism depended upon the idea that we had already socialized the relations of production to such a point that they no longer resemble the ownership of the production. That is, there's a social, a great deal of socialism going on in production, but it's not represented in the private holdings of the products or the means of making those products. And change here is economically determined. This is orthodox Marxism. Change is economically determined. It's determined by this dialectic, and it's determined by these processes, without which change doesn't happen. There has to be these processes, and it happens according to determined laws. According to Marx, it's a law. Another major feature in Marxism that will be important to the Frankfurt School is the notion of commodity fetishism. In fact, this is a very central issue for them, because they're concerned with the commodification of society, as it's called, the commodification of everything. Now, what is a fetish? A fetish is when we ascribe qualities to something that don't intrinsically inhere in it. So, for example, in Freud, there was the notion of the fetish, or the sexual fetish, for example, like a stocking, has no inherent sexual characteristics to it, but because it's connected to something that is deemed sexually important, it takes on a sexual characteristic, or shoe, to make a real reach. Or for Auguste Comte, the founder of sociology, positivistic sociology, the fetish was ascribed to physical, material things that were given supernatural qualities and venerated and so forth in the theological stage of development. Commodity fetishism, on the other hand, is fetishism, but it's when social relations are expressed as relations between commodities. And when the commodity is given a quality that it doesn't deserve, it doesn't really intrinsically have, it's given a social quality, it becomes a social being, effectively, which and our social relations become an expression of relations between commodities. Everything is commodified, so my relationship to you, yours to anyone else, all of these are relations of commodities. And here's a quote from Capital, Volume 1 on commodity fetishism. The mysterious character of the commodity form consists, therefore, simply in the fact that the commodity reflects the social characteristic of men's own labor as objective characteristics of the products of labor themselves, as the socio-natural properties of these things. So here he's talking about the fetish in the sense that the commodity reflects social characteristics of men's labor, but it doesn't look like men's labor. We don't look at a thing, he says, and think of the labor embodied in it. We look at it as a thing in itself that has its own value and its own characteristics, really, which is nothing more than the embodied labor that is in there. This becomes very central to the Frankfurt School. Another important issue is alienation. The labor produces for the capitalist at its discretion, at the capitalist discretion. That is, the labor is alienated from the process of production because he's not producing according to his own desiderata. He's doing so under the direction of the capitalist who's producing for his ends, not for the laborer. So when you go to make something or do production at a factory or whatever, this product is not being created at your behest or your discretion or for your needs directly. It's being directed by somebody else, and therefore you're alienated from production, you're alienated from your labor, and you're alienated from yourself. This is not existential. Existentialism's alienation. This is much more discrete in that we can point directly to why it's happening. The product also of the labor is alienated from the worker. It is not his property. That's another simple way of understanding alienation from a Marxist standpoint. You produce something and it's taken from you, as he put it. Okay, so these basic issues amount to Marx's critique of political economy. The basic account of the imperatives of capital, exploitation, commodity fetishism, and alienation was taken as basic to the structural and material foundations of capitalism and modernity. I will move to George Lukács. He was a Hungarian writer. He was a Marxist, and he lived under Soviet rule, but he was eventually ejected from the party for heresy, in effect. The heresy would actually be what we're talking about. What he did is return to the subjective factor. He brought the subject back into Marxism. And a return to the subjective factor meant that a truly critical theory of society had to locate the genesis of social change within the consciousness of the agents of that transformation, rather than any kind of laws or mechanistic or positivist laws operating externally to those agents. So he emphasizes or re-emphasizes what he thought to be lost out of Orthodox Marxism by the Second International and their complete and total objectification of the worker as a kind of cog in the wheel of history that would just turn with everything else, and finally things would turn out as they would in socialism. In his History and Class Consciousness, 1923, he reintroduces the working class as the subject in history, as opposed to the mechanistic economic determinism of the Second International. In What is Orthodox Marxism, Lukács introduced a corrective to Marxian dialectics, arguing that Engels, in particular, because Engels was particularly positivistic and determinist, he argued that the dialectical relation between the subject and the object in the historical process had been lost by the time that Marx died. In effect, and then Engels continued and effectively dropped the subject out of history entirely. Okay, so now we go on to the issue or the concept of reification, which is very similar to commodity fetishism and commodification, but it's more or less a combination, I guess, of the two. Lukács argues that in bourgeois society, commodified social relations, that is, the relations between people become a relationship between things, have produced the appearance of a phantom objectivity. So we're living in a world of a phantom objective world in which our relationships to each other are totally determined by the relationships between commodities, which stand in for the relationship between people. Commodification defines everything in bourgeois life, including social relations, science, philosophy, everything. In fact, in this book, Lukács goes on a long excursion talking about bourgeois philosophy, as he puts it, the terminus for which is Kant and Hegel, and Kant's inability to grasp or penetrate the transcendental object is a function of reification. In Reification and the Consciousness of the Proletariat, Lukács writes, "For at this stage in the history of mankind, there is no problem that does not ultimately lead back to that question. of the commodity. And there is no solution that cannot be found in the solution to the riddle of the commodity structure. So any problem in the world is based on commodification and the commodity. The problem of commodities must not be considered in isolation or even regarded as the central problem only in economics, but as the central structural problem of capitalist society in all its respects or aspects. So this is this commodification permeates everything. And everything is a reification. We live in a reified existence. With the complete commodification under capitalism, social relations become a relationship between things. They become reified, as I said. A relationship between people takes on the character of a thing itself and acquires a phantom objectivity. The working class, too, is commodified. This is essential to realize. The working class is a commodity. Labor is a commodity, so people are purchased as such. Now, we know it's their time that's purchased, but this turns it into their entire selves. Working class must become conscious of its own commodification to develop a revolutionary consciousness. So it is bursting out of this reified condition that must take place before any positive political or economic change can come. It's the consciousness. It all depends on the consciousness of the working class. This is definitely an emphasis that had been lost, if it ever was this strenuous to begin with. And that's why he was ejected from the party, because he went too far with this subjectivism here. The concept of reification becomes a basic and central character of the Frankfurt School's social and cultural criticism. This is absolutely undeniable. If you read anything on the Frankfurt School that's of any value, they'll say you must understand Lukács to be able to grasp it. So, let's wrap up the precursors, just in a couple slides here, a few slides. The idealism of Hegel is reintroduced into Marxism for its dialectical method, for the reintroduction of subjectivity, and for its progress narrative. Marxism is necessarily central to the Frankfurt School's project. It becomes a premise of all their work. Lukács' introduction of reification and the working class as a subject in history become central categories in the Frankfurt School's criticism. So that ends our discussion of the precursors to the Frankfurt School, and we'll begin an introduction to the Frankfurt School and two of their thinkers in our next segment. Thank you.